coming out on this nice sunny night and being indoors for our fifth storytelling night. And I'm Peggy, this is Jenny. Caitlin can't be here tonight, and we're really bummed about that, but probably not quite as bummed as she is. She's down in Homer, but she wanted us to tell everybody that she's would be here if she didn't have to be there for work, and she's excited to hear the stories afterwards because we are actually being taped tonight. But I want to welcome you all and thank everybody for coming out. And Jenny, you want to talk a little bit about what we're doing here tonight?
Sure. So how many of you have been to one of these before? Excellent. Anyone who just thought they were getting a nice quiet dinner at Odie's tonight, sorry. But not sorry, because you get entertainment along with your meal. So if you're at all familiar with the Moth Storytelling Hour or Arctic Entries in Anchorage, this is kind of our local version of that. So we come up with a theme, and then we challenge storytellers to think of a story that they can deliver with no notes, and it has to be true, in 7 minutes. And if you think that that is easy, well, then we want you to come to our next one because it's way easier than trying to twist arms. But it is definitely challenging and takes some nerve, so we appreciate everyone who participates. KDLL is recording this evening, so we're going to be airing that. So if you know of folks who really wanted to make it tonight and couldn't, you can let them know to check out our website, and we will announce when that will be on the air. Am I missing anything, Peggy? So first off, our first storyteller for the night is the walking irony himself, the scraggly guy who so immaculately grooms Salteshi Trails, facilities manager Bill Holt, who is a veteran at the oddities of life, and that makes him a wonderful veteran storyteller as well. You're up, Bill.
Nature versus not sure. So I think that pretty much includes anything that nature could run into contact with. So that's where I'm going with this story. Some of the stories I've told before had to do with pretty much everything I have ever told has to do with the natural world. So this is another fishing story, which seems to be where I spend most of my time. I don't know if anybody knows much about Cook Inlet, but I salmon fish in Cook Inlet. And across Cook Inlet is a place called Chinitna Bay. It's a beautiful place. It's actually part of a national park. And so every year we would go over there in the fall and try and catch silvers. And fishing for silvers is a real different thing than fishing for reds, at least out of a drift boat, because when you fish for silver salmon, they swim right along the shoreline. And so the idea on catching silver salmon is you have to have your net pretty much within 1 inch of water clear out to whatever the length of the net is. And so to do that, you have to try and get your net in as close as you can to the beach, and then you set your net offshore. Well, it's kind of hard to do because the boats are kind of deep, and you can't get in really close. And then you also have this double whammy issue of it's illegal for your buoy to go dry. So years and years ago, we used to all live in fear of this fishing game enforcement guy named Al Thompson. Al Thompson, the reputation with Al Thompson was if your net goes dry, if your buoy goes dry, Al's going to be hiding in a hollow tree on the beach, and he's going to see your net go dry. So you have this built-in fear of what's going to happen if Al catches you, but you also have this urge to do the best you can because we're fishermen or predators, and we're trying to maximize what we catch fishing. So I was in Chinitna Bay at a place called Clam Cove. Clam Cove is a beautiful cove with a nice point. And so it was an ebb tide. That means the tide was going out. So I kind of got in as close as I could to the beach and thrown my net out. I had my son, who was probably 12 years old, and my deckhand, who this was her first time fishing. This was kind of a post-season deal. So we kind of threw the stuff out as best we could, and we slowly kind of set the net out to where we got to the end of the net. And the idea then is to not get so far out that the water's deep enough that it takes and washes you away out into the inlet. So, and that would pull the net off of the beach. That's the concern, is to not have the net pull off the beach. So we got out to the end about as far as we could get, and we were probably in 6 or 7 feet of water. And then I disconnected the boat from the net because the current would have pulled the boat out around this point. So I was watching the net fishing, and we started catching a few fish. Everything was looking really kind of cool. Beautiful place, sunny day, looked out into Chinitna Bay and a pod of orcas, swam up the bay. Everything was just beautiful. And we were watching the net, watching the orcas swimming up the bay, and all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose on the net. And I thought, first, my thought was, oh my God, one of those orcas is over here trying to get in my net. And then I looked again, it was about 100 feet down from where the boat was. The whole net's going underneath the water, coming back up, going underneath the water, coming back up, and it's jerking the net, and it's pulling it around. And then I saw the fin come up. And it was a shark. It was a poor beagle, which is also called a salmon shark. And I thought, oh, crap. Now I've got a shark in the net. I don't know what I'm going to do with this shark. But the worst part of the shark being in the net was it started pulling the net off of the beach. So then, since I'm a predator too, I'm thinking, oh, my God, now those salmon are going to get around the inside of my net. So I'm watching this net kind of pull off the beach, looking at this shark. And I knew if I got onto the net and got back to the shark, by the time I got the shark out, I would have washed around the point too and pulled the net completely off the beach. So I'm watching this shark. My son, my 12-year-old son's all excited watching this shark. My deckhand, who's actually never been on a boat before, is real excited about the shark, and I'm just mad. So the shark's messing around with the net, and it's starting to pull off, and we're watching this, and all of a sudden, Galen, my son, says, hey, look, Dad, up on the beach. And I looked up on the beach, and there was a bear. A black bear walked out of the woods, and he sat there high up on the beach, and he was watching us. And now we got orcas, we got a shark, and we got a bear on the beach. And so I'm thinking, well, I wasn't even thinking about the bear, really. I was just trying to figure out how to deal with this shark. And so I'm sitting there watching this, and the bear walks down the beach, and he walks right down to the beach, and he kind of gets near my buoy, and he just sits there, and he's watching my buoy too. He's watching all the commotion, and he's watching the buoy bob around, and he sees that the buoy is coming out into the water. So he's a bear. So he's watching this buoy, and he kind of gets up, and he walks down, and he starts swatting the buoy. And so the buoy, because the buoy's still kind of moving out of the water with the shark pulling it, the bear kind of is watching it, and all of a sudden, he just takes the buoy, both hands, pulls it up, and bites the buoy, and then he pulls it back up the beach. And I'm thinking, this is great. God has really conspired. The universe is aligned, and this bear is going to pull the net up the beach. But then the bear kept pulling the net up the beach, and now I start worrying about Al Thompson again. Because I'm sure that Al's hiding in that hollow tree somewhere. And I'm thinking, I got to take pictures of this because I have to prove that I did not set that buoy up on the beach. And so this went on for a while. First, so then the bear dropped the buoy. The shark pulled the buoy back out into the water. The bear came back down, grabbed the buoy again, pulled it up. And now it's a flat buoy anyway. It's not going to float. So he pulled it up. And this went on probably 3 or 4 times. And finally, the bear walked away. The shark kind of got the net far enough off the water that I realized I had to deal with it. So I pulled up, got the shark out of the net, tried to roll the shark out of the net. In the process of doing this, the tide caught me, and I kind of slid out around the point and went on out into Chinitna Bay, continued picking up my net, and it was one of the very best silver salmon sets I had ever had. So there's probably a moral here. I don't know. We were all three predators after the same prey. So anyway, thank you.
Bill, you're really tall. Okay, Dr. Matt, I'm going to get this about your height. I'd like to introduce Matt Pahala. Matt has been chasing bears and kayaking and falling out of trees for most of his life, in all likelihood. His grandfather was a homesteader, and we've heard him share stories before, but Matt, who is walking slowly after some back surgery and ready to get out and about and in his kayak, is going to share with us a fun story tonight, and he has a drawing to go along with it as well. Matt.
Look at all those sun-kissed Alaskans. Like it. So if I had to have a title for my story, it would be Don't Feed the Bears. And so that's what my illustration is. I'll just set it here. If you look up the Garcia bear-resistant food container on the internet, the details include a description that says something to the order of, "Don't feed the bears. 614 cubic inches of bear-proof food storage capacity. Made out of ABS polymer, smooth sides and rounded edges so bears can't get a hold of it." So the other nice thing about the Garcia bear-proof container is that it comes with a nice nylon carrying case with all kinds of straps attached to it so you can strap it to your backpack or onto another load. So that's kind of where my story starts. I went on, as Peggy said, I do a lot of kayaking. I went on this kayak adventure where we were doing some base camping in Halibut Cove at Wright Beach. So we went and we set up our camp at Wright Beach, which, if you haven't been there, let me just sort of set the stage. It's this really, really nice gravel beach with some sand, pretty steep approach. There's a sand dune behind it with some nice seagrasses, and then it moves into this really nice, soft, mossy area of forest that is a mature but young spruce forest, so really good trees for setting up your bear hang and also for tarps over your tents, and just like the ideal place to set up a camp and hang out there for several days. So that's what we did several years in a row. We would go and set up tents. We'd get Mako's water taxi to take us over, so we all packed heavy and, you know, a lot of food and other adult beverages and whatnot. And we always wanted to be very conscious of our food at this place because it was such a good place to camp in a popular place that it's like a fed bear is a dead bear. And so it was always this mantra that we, you know, we would always take care of our food, have the specific cooking site. Everything would either be in a bear hang or in a bear-proof container. You know, all of those responsible bear area camping things that you take note of. So plan was that well, let me describe our bear hang a little bit. So my friend Levi and I, we set up our bear hang, and we put all of our bulky stuff up there, but I had bought the Garcia bear-proof container to house the things that I wanted easy access to. I didn't want to have to deal with taking the bear hang down, because anyone who's dealt with that, it takes a while. And so in the morning when you roll out of bed and you want to make coffee, you want to make coffee right now. So my coffee and my chocolate and my peanut butter and jelly and honey and, you know, Gorp and dried fruits and all the quick energy things that I just, you know, I want to get to that right now. So I have those sitting underneath the bear hang at the stump of the tree. And so I've got my bear container there, and my friend Levi has a couple, and, you know, it's sort of there's this like grab bag of bear-proof containers underneath the bear hang. And so we go out in the morning, and the plan was we're going to paddle out and spend the morning in this area playing in some tide races and doing some other exciting things, and then come back to camp for lunch. So I just had a quick breakfast and just a couple snacks, but the tide races were really good. So we stayed out there a little longer than planned. And so by the time we hit the beach, I was sort of hitting that glycogen low, like the glucose needed to come up pretty quick. So we haul the boats up and get them up above what the tide's going to do while we're eating. And I go over to my where I'd left my bear-proof container, and I'm looking around for it, and I see everyone else's, but mine's not there. I'm like, all right, well, I don't know. Maybe I left it over at the cook place. So I walk over to the cook tent, and that's not there. So I'm like, well, maybe in my rush I left it at my tent. So I go and walk over to my tent, and it's not there, and I'm kind of scratching my head, turning. And as I'm turning away, out of the corner of my eye, I notice that there are three parallel razor-like cuts in my rain fly. And it's like this tingle kind of goes up the back of my neck, and I'm like, oh, yeah, there was a bear here. And it was that tingle of there's a bear here, but then I'm like, they stole my bear-proof container, and it has all of my coffee and my chocolate and my peanut butter. And so I'm kind of pissed because that's, like, the important things. I don't care about my mountain house and all the other bulky stuff that's up in the bear hang. I want my chocolate and my coffee. So this is what I think happened. I'm pretty sure that at the same time that we were hitting the beach, these bears were in the camp, and they were probably, you know, freshly there. Otherwise, my tent would have been destroyed. But here's sort of the dialogue that I imagined going on in the bear's mind.
Hey, do you smell that? Smells like coffee and chocolate and peanut butter. I love coffee and chocolate and peanut butter. We should go check that out. Okay, let's go. I can't open these bear-proof containers with my claws. What should we do? I don't know. You work on that. I'm going to go check out the tent. Okay. Well, the tent doesn't really have anything in it that I can smell, but let me take a look. Oh, snap! They're at the beach already! Let's get out of here! Run away! Run away! Hey! This bear-proof container has a nylon carrying strap. I got it.
And then he runs up the hill. So that's pretty much what I think happened in the whole scenario. You know, I proceeded to search around for my bear-proof container. I even went up the hill with my friend, and we ended up in this area where it was just Devil's Club forever, and it was about this high. And I'm like, well, I don't see a way through. Let me duck down and see what I can see. Oh, that's Black Bear Superhighway down here. I mean, there was bear scat everywhere. It was, like, obviously bear country. So we got out of there pretty quick. And for the next couple days, we dealt with these two bears. They're, like, two-year-old black bears. They collapsed a couple of tents. They drug this one guy's duffel bag out into, like, nothing in the duffel bag, but close. They jumped off of a rock onto a cooler that was kind of hung and collapsed it down. That person didn't have a good bear hang. They weren't in our party, by the way. But on the return, I went to the Garcia website, and I had to leave a review, and it's basically something like this. Whereas I don't dispute the effectiveness of your bear-proof container, the only feedback I have for those contemplating purchasing your item or who have already have that is the carrying strap makes a really good carrying strap. So, you know, maybe get rid of that before you leave it.
So up next we have Peggy Erkenef, who is a published author and the communication specialist for the school district. So you can hear her on the radio and see her in print in various places through those venues. And she's a lifelong reader and lifelong story accumulator and story sharer and a wonderful person to kind of spearhead this event. So welcome, Peggy.
So imagine it's a dark and stormy night in Alaska, in Kisilov, the place where when I first moved there a few months later, I met somebody and said I was from Kisilov, and he looked at me and said, "Do you need me to speak slowly?" But it's a dark and stormy night. There's only trees to the east and to the south. From the west, where I am in my log house, I can hear Sterling Highway occasionally and the screech of a brake or a honk or a low hum of traffic. Actually, it wasn't a dark and stormy night. It just felt that way. It was a bright, sunny afternoon in August at about a temperature like this. I was standing on the porch of my log house, barefoot in shorts and a tank top, and I was talking to a little orphaned moose who'd been hanging about the house and the hood. And I'd been talking to this moose for several weeks at this point. The moose had shown up in June with a big, mean cow and a twin. We often have twins around in the neighborhood. But the moose was by itself at this point. And I discovered that my bird bath, the ceramic bright blue one by my front door area, was a wonderful feeding little drinking fountain for the moose. It was perfect height, which actually made me really happy. And the moose was so sweet, and I was starting to connect with this moose so much that I actually didn't mind when it was eating my flowers and in the garden. But on this day, I stood looking at this moose because I was really concerned. The moose wasn't doing so well anymore. And my neighbor had called me up the hill and said to me, "What can we do about the moose? It's not going to survive. What agency can come?" And he's only here for a couple weeks every summer. So I called Bunny Swan, who's sitting right here, my best friend. I said, "Bunny, I've got the orphan moose. What do I do? And it's not doing too well, and it's feeling a little sick." And she said, "Oh, well, let's build it a barn, and we'll come bottle feed it." And I said, "I'm not ready for that. I'll give you a call back. Call my friend Mike." And Mike says to me, "Well, go cut some birch branches and fireweed and feed it." Well, okay, that's a good idea, too. And then I called Ted Spraker on Board a Game, who's answered my questions for 8 years when I was on the advisory committee for Fish and Game, and said, "Ted, I've got this moose. My neighbor wants me to get an agency out here. It's the weekend. What can we do?" And he says, "Peggy, sorry. No one's going to take that moose. And I know this is the harsh way of the wild. And you want to help it. But the best thing you can do is do nothing. You don't." I said, "But Mike said feed it." And he said, "Don't feed it. To give it a chance, don't do anything feeding it. The best thing you can do is keep the neighborhood dogs away from it." So I'm holding all this in my heart, and I've been reading this book all summer called Kastner's Cutthroats, and I've been thinking about this phrase that's in this book called "I'll See you a Little Farther Up the Creek," and I've been thinking about the wild characters and the people, the Alaskans, that ruggedness of survival. And I actually named the moose Enoki after a character in this book. And then I later discovered he was a she, so it's Amelia Enoki. So that day on my porch, I'm standing there and I'm talking to Enoki. And Enoki is no farther away from me than where Shaylin's standing right back there. And in between us is a tree that's got a trunk about yay round, and three stalks that come up that split. So one here, one here, and one here. And I'm telling Enoki, "I really want to help you. And Bunny said this, and Mike said this, but Ted said this, and I don't know what to do." And I realized suddenly this moose has been like taking steps over the last several weeks towards me, and it's lost its mom. It probably heard its mom get hit by a car and the sound of that. And then its twin. And I'm the one safe place. So I say to the moose, the only thing I can do is I'll give you water and I'll make sure you're safe from dogs. And at that moment, I kid you not, it was a blue sky. It was a day like this. There was the loudest crack I've heard, and two of those tree branches fell down like this, with one standing to the ground, and they stayed connected. So tree trunk and branch here, two huge branches are now at calf height with lots of leaves. Enoki bolted, and I just stood there, and I said, oh, okay. About an hour later, Enoki was back eating leaves and then sleeping in the little structure that had almost been created. Enoki stayed with me through the fall, and I had a lot of conversations as we got closer and closer. And I realized that Enoki and I were more similar than I thought. I too had to learn how to survive in Alaska in those woods by myself. And we have so much hidden support. And so I saw Enoki for the last time on Thanksgiving. He showed up at my house. She did. I still call her Enoki. And my neighbor is here. So Tracy also had the pleasure of Amelia Enoki. My neighbors all laughed when I said that I had named her. But I'm hoping I'll see her again. She might have been back in January. And I trust that maybe I'll see her a little further up the creek. Thank you. Now I'd like to invite Kelsey back up for a song. Kelsey started writing music when she was in middle school. She is an Alaskan and a local gal who graduated from Skyview and delights us with her song.
Right, I will now deliver you guys a story in the way that I'm comfortable telling stories, which is through song. I am a local girl. I left for college because that seemed like a good idea because I knew I'd want to live here in the future. Came back, but I have a little bit of that travel bug in me, so I'm usually not in the state for much more than a year if I can help it. Without getting away for a month or so and seeing some new places. But then by the time that month or so is over, I'm so ready to come back here. That's a good feeling every time. But the first time I did that, I had been back from school for about 6 months or something. I was like, all right, I'm doing it. I'm gonna go see some of the world. So I just went and visited like every friend that I knew of that lived in a different state. So I just bopped around and saw all of them. And so I ended up, I think I was in like Spokane, Washington, and then I was outside of Chicago, and then I was in New York City, and then I was in Austin, Texas, and like by the time these weeks were rolling by, I was just like, where are the forests? Where are like the mountains and the nature? And I just kind of started to feel not myself, I guess. I was loving every minute, but just craving that. So I remember, I think I ended up heading back towards Spokane, and then was heading to Western Washington, and I took a train, and at some point I woke up and I looked out the window and I was just in the mountains, and there were orchards and just vegetation everywhere. There's probably like a little deer that waved at me as the train went by or something. But anyway, when I left Texas and headed back to the West Coast, I wrote this song. Take me to the mountains where the spruce trees kiss the blue skies. Take me to the valley where you found me for the first time. These flat lands can't carry my heart. They let it fall into the wilderness where I can't see other people. You, me, dear, and the midnight sun, I can see you until winter. We'll find a cave in the mountains and get snowed in until spring. Take me to your beating heart, I will hear playing for me. Even in the strongest storm, I will find my way back to you. We'll watch the sun rise and fall, the volcanoes resting but never.
Thank you.
Wow, that was beautiful. You should definitely be writing songs. So I have the pleasure of introducing a new storyteller to us tonight, Allie Cunningham. She's a writer and a reader, and she's just embarked on a really huge new adventure. She works as a firefighter and up on the refuge, and she's being really brave right now. And let's all give her a round of applause for being willing to share us a story.
As Peggy said, I'm like way more comfortable with writing things and then reading them than speaking them. So we'll see how this one goes. But this is about a really recent story. Some of you that are in this room sitting in front of me were involved in this story. So my history with Alaska is I came up here from Indiana about 4 years ago. And if you know anything about Indiana, you know it's really flat. Like Kelsey was alluding to just now, how flatlands can't carry your heart. I feel like I felt very much the same way. So I moved west eventually and couldn't get over mountains and the weight that they held. So I received a phone call 4 years ago in January from a Knowles instructor. It's a National Outdoor Leadership School. One of my sailing instructors called me and said, "Hey, do you want a job on a fishing tender?" And I was like, "Sick, I get to go to Alaska. This is awesome." So I like dropped everything and came up here on a whim and found myself in what I think is one of the most beautiful places in the world, and that's Prince William Sound. And I was just completely taken. Had never been anywhere that was this beautiful that had captured my heart so much. So a week ago, we went out there, Hollis and some friends in this room and I, and we had our wedding out there. So this is a story of my wedding, which is cool. it's great. So it's like 6 a.m. We wake up really early, not early enough. Leave town. If you know how far away Whittier is from here, you know it's 2 hours. Like, give it 2 hours because you have to get through the tunnel, right? So we leave town. We're trying to make the 9:30 tunnel, which you can only get through it until 9:45. I thought it was like 9:50. I was like, oh, we're going to be fine. 7:30 when we're leaving. Start going in a big convoy. Some of our friends are already there. We're like late. So this is the first moment, right? We're late. We get to the tunnel, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, is Hollis going to make it? He's behind me. He's got a canoe on his truck, and it's blowing like 50 going into Portage. If you've ever been in that pass there, you know it's really windy. So I call him, and I'm like, where are you? He's like, I got to fix the canoe. I got to stop. I'm like, all right, you might miss the tunnel. Whatever. So we get there. incident averted. They get the canoe fixed. We make the tunnel. Go through the tunnel. It's pouring rain. This is also something it does in Whittier constantly, if you're not aware. It's a beautiful place. Prince William Sound is beautiful, but like 80% of the time, it's raining in sheets. It's not just raining. It's like hardcore four-layer Gore-Tex, doesn't matter. Get over yourself. You're going to get wet. So we go through, pop on the water taxi. I've got like 9 friends in tow, you know, some of whom are not accustomed to these conditions at all, and they're just completely taking my word for the fact that, like, we're going to be fine. It's going to be a great adventure. Come along. I promise. I'll carry you if I have to. So so we get on this water taxi. We're psyched. I'm like, it's raining. Whatever. We're fine. So pull up, get off the boat. Step 1. Unload all your gear, which is way too much gear for what we're getting into. Way too much. We have like a cooler. We have like 2 watermelons. Thanks, Caitlin. and a bunch of other stuff. So I'm like, whatever, we'll make it work. It's fine, because this is my attitude. And I'm trying to like absorb this into my friends who are probably thinking, Allie's crazy. What am I doing? So we have like rounds of kayaks. We have 9 of us in like 4 boats, a canoe and 3 kayaks. We're like, we can canoe. It's a lagoon. It's great. So we load all our gear up. 1 trip. I'm in the first trip because we brought our dogs too, because I can't get married without my dog. He's like my best friend. So dog, Hollis, Joel, Joel's dog in canoe. Dogs have never been in a canoe. Not sure about it. It's fine. We're going to a place we've never been to. It's pouring rain. Whatever. So we start boating, and we eventually get to where we're going. We see, I have a map on my phone, which isn't really currently working very well because it's raining, and you need a touch screen, and touch screens don't work in the rain. So I'm like, oh, guys, we're right here. It's cool. So beach the boats. There are 3 feet of snow. 3 feet last week in Prince William Sound. So we have 5 pairs of snowshoes and 9 people. More like 4 pairs of snowshoes and 9 people with a bunch of gear. Okay, so we're sitting here on the shore, and at this point, I'm thinking to myself, this is a really bad idea. What am I doing? And I have to act like it's a great idea for all my friends. So I'm like, all right, just come on, girl. You can do it. Get psyched. So Joel and Hollis go away on the boat, and then I'm really thinking this is a really bad idea because they got to go get more friends and more gear. So I start trying to scout this trail. It's hemmed in by terrain features. I know we're going to get to the cabin. We all know we're going to get there. Explaining this to everyone else was not the easiest feat, because inside I'm freaking out. Like, if I had an in-reach right now, I'm going to call the water taxi. We're just going to go home. Do it later. It's fine. So we just start walking eventually once we get everybody all loaded up. I start walking with really heavy backpacks or dry bags or whatever. Still really not sure at this moment. And I'm one with snowshoes on. Half of my friends are post-holing, like up to their knees in snow, right? And we're just like, it's great. This is awesome. What are you talking about? This is great. Oh, man. So okay. So we decide to ditch some gear and do the whole thing. And we ditch the heavy packs, and we just start walking as fast as we can to get here. And we know that 3 of us are going to have to come back later, no matter how wet we are, even though the cabin's going to be dry, and come back and get the rest of this stuff. So we just keep trucking and trucking and trucking. And we get to the cabin, and it's the coolest thing ever, because it's like, oh, I see the cabin! But we actually saw the cabin before we could get to it. Like, you know, maybe at least an hour before we could get there, we see this cabin. We're like, we're almost there! It's right there! I know I can get there! No, not really. Keep walking. Or try. So we get there, and we get dry, and then a couple of us load back up and go out and get the rest of the stuff, and we're just so thankful we have a warm place to go back to, and it's amazing. And then we go to bed. We try to go to bed early, but we're like, oh, we have all this beer. We have to drink some, otherwise we're going to have to hike it out. That's going to suck. So get that taken care of. Because you never want to hike out with stuff you brought in. That's like way bad. Next day we wake up, it's gorgeous. It's like the most beautiful banner Prince William Sound Day. If you've ever seen it, you know what I'm talking about. It's like just golden. And we got married, and it was great. So, you know, if you ever go into something and you think you're not going to make it, I think you can make it. You can make it.
That is true. You never want to haul out disposable goods. You can make yourself a big old weird dinner and have lots of beverages on your last night. Although you are carrying most of it still, but it's not on your back, so it's like more, I don't know, dispersed better. So up next we have John Messick, who is an instructor at Kenai Peninsula College, and he encourages everyone to take his creative writing class next fall. So I think this officially counts as the most like direct marketing way to register students ever, and KPC should definitely give him a raise.
How's it going? So this is more of an anecdote, but it's about usefulness. I think the nature of people who come into Alaska is that we have this strange tendency to believe that everything, like everything, is possibly useful in some way, which I think explains like the refrigerators at the end of all the roads and like our unwillingness to take them to the dumps and the like 7 RVs in my neighbor's yard. And all of these various things. So this one is actually about squirrels, but there's a quick prelude. So when I came to Alaska, I came actually by way of Canada. In a roundup, everyone kind of comes by Canada if you drive, but I spent a summer in the Canadian North first on a river. A friend and I were fighting fire in Arizona, and we looked at a map and wanted to do a river trip. And the Yukon seemed really intimidating and big, so we looked at the only other river that had a name on like a map of North America, and it was the Mackenzie River. And there was a road out of Fort Nelson off the Alcan and another road that was in Inuvik. So we bought a canoe off Craigslist and spent 2 months on the river. And we learned this really cool thing on the river one day. We're like 70 miles. As it turns out, the Mackenzie's like almost twice the size of the Yukon. So that was a good lesson there. And a lot less people, a lot less development. And so we hadn't seen people in a couple of weeks, and this boat came floating by with 3 folks who were moose hunting. And they asked if we'd seen any moose. They asked how we hadn't. And they noticed we had a shotgun because we were scared of bears. And they... apparently Canadians are less paranoid about bears or something, but they thought we were going to use it to shoot ducks, and there happened to be a flock of ducks floating by. So we get into this boat and go tearing up the river after these ducks, which I know now, not being as naive, that that's a really irresponsible thing to do. But at the time, I thought this was great fun, and I was connecting with the locals and all of this wonderful stuff. And so we drive up and down chasing these ducks around for a while, and eventually the older man in the boat goes, "No, we don't have enough gas to get back to the village," which was like 70 miles away. And he was like totally unconcerned with this. And I was like floored. I was like, how can you not be like just terrified? You're like out of gas and like 150 miles from the nearest anything. And he's like, well, nature provides. And he showed me Labrador tea. And there were berries that were coming in. And, of course, there were ducks. And it was like I had this moment where everything in nature in the north actually became, like, possibly useful. So when I moved to Alaska, I, like, took this mentality with me to Fairbanks, to a dry cabin, and decided to apply it to the squirrels that were living in my ceiling. So it gets cold in the winter in Fairbanks, like really cold. My wife, Molly, once called it hallucinatory kind of cold. And when you don't have real insulation, spruce cones are not a substitute. And so there's this other thing that happens when you live in the... they call them dry cabin ghettos in Fairbanks, and they're really poorly built little cabins that are ridiculously overpriced for what you're getting, and they don't really retain warmth, and they have little toyos that don't really heat to begin with, and then you're sleeping in it like the middle of the night, it's like 3:30 in the afternoon in the winter, the squirrels start scratching, and they scratch like little wood shavings and then insulation. So I was starting to get hives from the insulation, like falling down like fiberglass on my face in the middle of the night. And I had to do something. So I had this buddy who was a trapper, and I borrowed some number one Martin traps because that was what I knew how to set, and set them up on the edge of the cabin and smeared some peanut butter on them. And pretty soon I was running a very successful trap line. I had like 10 of them. So this is where the usefulness comes in, because I was learning quickly that everything in Alaska has to be useful. And I thought, well, these squirrels could probably be useful. Like, so I started doing some research. And my parents had sent me this book, the University of Georgia Extension. University of Alaska does not have a cookbook, but University of Georgia does. And so I guess my parents thought, Georgia, Alaska, what's the difference? You're not anywhere near Wisconsin and, you know, have a cookbook. But they had this recipe for canned squirrel. I'm just going to read it because I teach English. And I think, you know, if you're citing something, what's in quotes is sacred. So the University of Georgia Extension Canning Cookbook says, for canned squirrel that you should soak meat for 1 hour in brine by dissolving 1 tablespoon of salt per quart of water. Rinse, and then use preparation procedures and processing times recommended for poultry, omitting the salt. Which seemed like really simple. Like, I could do this. Like, I could just skin some squirrels, and I could, like, you know, process them. So I waited. I kept them in a 5-gallon bucket frozen on the porch, and stuff piling up in the yard, until I had, like, probably, I don't know, 10, 11 squirrels in a bucket on the porch. And I brought them in, and I skinned them, which actually I had never really skinned a squirrel before, so that took a long time, skinning squirrels. And then I, like, carefully, like, extracted all of the meat off of these squirrels, 10 squirrels, and in the end I had not quite enough for a half pint jar. So I stuck it in a freezer, and I let it get freezer burned, and eventually I did what I really dreaded doing, because I don't actually like killing things. I threw them away. I threw the meat away. I couldn't bring myself to eat it. I think ultimately the lesson that I learned from these squirrels is that maybe not everything is useful, but I've also learned that there is this profound connection that comes by trying to see it that way. This last week, we went up Russian River Trail and we collected nettles and came home and made nettle pesto. We made fiddlehead pickles. We have rhubarb in our garden. By the end of the summer, we're going to have smoked salmon groaning on the shelves. We'll have meat in the freezer, and all of it is kind of coming from the land. And all of it connects us to this really, really wonderful place that we live in. And I think that's one of the really great powers of finding balance in this place. And so sometimes, like late at night, I'll just look at the shelves of stuff that we've managed to keep and make useful. The only thing that we'll never see on that shelf ever is a jar of squirrel. Thanks.
That was awesome. Thank you. I'll never look at squirrels the same again, especially the one that's trying to take roost in the birdhouse on my deck. So, it's now my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Claire Swan, the mother of one of my best friends who if you've come before, you've heard Bunny Swan singing here. So Claire told me, just introduce me as a lifelong Alaskan who grew up in Kenai. She said, and my daughter arm twisted me to do this storytelling. I said, okay, I can do that. Except her daughter, Bunny, also arm-twisted me, sorry, Claire, to also share the profound respect that we have for you, Claire, as a tribal elder, as someone who is in the Alaska Hall of Fame as a woman, and who the Dena'ina Center for the Children was named after you. So we are very privileged to have somebody who knows our community and our land, and nature versus nature and nurture. Very well to share a story for us here tonight for the first time, Claire.
So I suppose you're expecting a good story, aren't you? Well, my story is about it's about nature. It's about two ladies who live in Kenai, lived in Kenai. And people have shared how this place is. And this, I always think about it as Kenai, as I think about here I am in this place, because because it has a it's all a place of its own. And it has a way of making people at home. And when you go away, you want to come back. And if you're lucky, you can. That's what happened to me. Well, anyway, this when Bunny made me do this last night, I was thinking, what am I going to do? You know, because I don't know anything. And anyway, this is a story of two ladies who lived in Kenai. And they were very different ladies, and one of them was a Dena'ina woman, and her name was, I will call her Auntie Fiona. And the other lady, and she was a Dena'ina woman, a gifted healer, a nice little plump, just a great person that you want to be, have, you should have for your grandma. My mom was really skinny, and she didn't have a great lap, but Fiona did. And then across town from Auntie Fiona lived Matrona Peterson, Auntie Peterson. And while Auntie Fiona was plump and just buzzed all over and got a whole lot of things done and knew everything and could heal people, Auntie Peterson was tall and stylish. And she had a store. She had a grocery store. She had a successful grocery store up the hill from a place called Salt House John's. And we used to call that. And so they would get together and visit. And you could listen, but you couldn't talk when any of the elders were talking. And to make sure that you didn't know anything, they would talk Russian and Dena'ina. And boy, oh boy, did you have to work hard to catch up. Well, anyway, one day I was there with my friend, with Fiona's granddaughter, Auntie Fiona's granddaughter, and they were sitting quietly at the table drinking tea and talking, and they had a lot to discuss, and they were going on in Russian and Dena'ina. And so we noticed that their voices started getting louder and louder and louder. And so pretty soon, they were yelling at each other. The only English words were Roosevelt and what's wrong with you? And so, you know, and Auntie Peterson was a person who, when she walked, it was like she was leading a convoy of ships. I could see her now coming from the church on Sunday morning from the Russian church in her jazzy Sears blue coat. And she owned the world. And I can see Auntie Fiona going, there goes that woman again. Ew. No. Well, anyway, so this, and we were just sitting there, and you couldn't talk because they would tell you to be quiet, or if they'd tell you again, out the door you went. So there's this Roosevelt, Russian some more. What's wrong with you? And finally, it got a little quiet. Oh, and I have to tell you, things don't change. Auntie Fiona would go, guess what, you know. And Auntie Peterson, you know, Roosevelt this and Roosevelt that, and what's wrong with you? And so finally, it got really still, and Auntie Fiona had scored a point. Aha! So Auntie Peterson gets up, slaps the table, said, "Bullshit! We all understood that." She goes steaming out the door. No. Auntie Fiona goes. So it just goes to show that no matter where you are and how different you are, everybody's the same. Everything's the same. And times change and people don't. Thank you.
Would Kelsey come back to the stage, please? However you would like that now.
Thanks, Jenny.
To share one more song with you guys. When I was thinking about this theme, nature versus not sure, I just couldn't get this particular song out of my head in regards to that theme, so I'll let you make of that what you will. This is a Big Mama Thornton song that I learned by way of Patty Griffin. Well, I smell a rat, babe. I smell a rat, baby. So you better watch out, 'cause I smell a rat, babe. You come stumbling down the hall, bump your head up against a wall, knocked down drunk, and that ain't all. I know you've been having yourself a ball. I smell a rat, babe. I smell a rat, baby. You better watch out, 'cause I smell a rat, babe. You won't tell me where you've been, whiskey running all down your chin. I smell a rat, babe. I smell a rat, baby. You better watch out, 'cause I smell a rat, babe. You come stumbling down the hall. You bumped your head up against that wall. You're knocked down drunk, and that ain't all. I know you've been having yourself a ball. I smell a rat, babe. I smell a rat, baby. I smell a rat, babe. I smell a rat, baby. I smell a rat, babe. I smell a rat, baby. And you better watch out, 'cause I smell a rat, babe. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Peggy.
All right, up next we have Kat Sorensen. Kat is a writer and journalist at the Peninsula Clarion. She was supposed to cover this event, but pawned it off on her coworker, which I'm assuming means that's why Ben is wandering around with a camera. So she could tell a story instead. She is originally from New Jersey, but broke her 3-month mark on the peninsula a few days ago and loves it.
Okay,
Okay. So like Jenny said, I haven't been here very long, but the story I wanted to tell tonight was about my first Alaska hike. I went with my friend Liz and Ben, that very, very, very tall man you saw walking around tonight. And as you could possibly imagine, it's hard to keep up with somebody whose legs reach your eyeballs. So we got out to Skelak Trail, and I was struggling to keep up with them the whole time. Making sure with every step I thought, okay, you can do this, okay, you can do this, okay, you can do this. It turns out I couldn't do it. It took me a very, very, very long time to finish that hike with a lot of stops that I blamed on, oh, I just have to take a picture for my mom. She's so excited I'm in Alaska. But that's not why it took me so long to do that hike. It's because I actually have been smoking for 10 years of my life. And the story I wanted to tell you tonight was how when I was on that trail, I looked around me and realized that I love hiking, I love Alaska, and I don't want to smoke because it's holding me back. So I wanted to tell you how after that hike, I went home and I broke all my cigarettes and smoked my last one in my cabin and threw them out, and that was the last cigarette that I ever had. But I can't tell you that story because I smoked a cigarette last night. So the story that I will tell you is about all the other cigarettes that I really enjoyed, but in this moment, can't deal with. We can talk about the first cigarette I ever had, which is the one where I was in my house surrounded by lighters and my dad's empty, full ashtrays, never empty, my dad's full ashtrays. And I was home alone. I was 15 years old at the time. And I was just pacing back and forth, trying to figure out something to do because I don't really, if I try to look back at it, what do 15-year-olds do with their free time? They can't leave? I don't know. That's a different story I'll think about another day. But I was just walking around, I guess, and went to go sit on the couch. And as I went to go sit on the couch, I realized that one of my dad's emergency pack of cigarettes was right there. And my dad has smoked my entire life, since the day I was born. Before I was born. And my mom smoked up until the time that her mother passed away from lung cancer. So she got the gist of it. But my dad smoked my entire life. My mom smoked. And I sit down on the couch to just watch TV, and I crush my dad's cigarettes. And I'm like, God, I'm going to get in trouble for this. So I get up, and I go to put him on the table. But instead of putting on the table, I open it up. And instead of then closing it and putting on the table, I open it up, and I take out a cigarette. And instead of putting the cigarette back and closing it and putting it on the table, I open it up, I take out the cigarette, and I put it in my mouth, and I smoke it, and I'm 15 years old, and I smoke my first cigarette. And I hated every second of it. I said, I'm never going to do it again. That was disgusting. That was horrible. For the next 5 years, I told myself and everyone around me, smoking's bad. It's killing my father. Just look at it. And then I smoked another cigarette, and it was delicious. I was on the canals of Venice with the man I thought I was going to marry, and he was a heavy smoker at the time. And he looks at me, and he says, you know, it would be great right now if we could just share a cigarette. And I said, oh, yes, it would. So we pass this Lucky Strike back and forth as we dangle our toes in the canals of Venice. And doesn't that just sound amazing? And then I started dabbling a little bit here and there, and then the next cigarette that I distinctly remember is the one that I smoked as I walked away from his house because he broke my heart and I never saw him again. And then from that point on, I said, hey, it's his fault I'm smoking. He gave me that pack of cigarettes. But it's not his fault that I was smoking. It's in my nature. I grew up around cigarettes. I am anxious by nature, and somehow they calm me down. And I have all of these great memories of my life and smoking a cigarette at this point in my life and things like that. But I need to change my nature because I want to be out in this world and experience everything that Alaska has to offer and not fall so very far behind my friend Liz, because she is really good at hiking and I am really bad at saying no to a cigarette. So last night, I get home and I'm very, very excited. Good day at work, gonna go out, do some stuff, I don't know, have fun. And I walk into the house and there's a pack of yellow American Spirits sitting right on the counter. I love yellow American Spirits. It's been 2 months since I smoked one, and I didn't smoke a cigarette for a very, very, very long time after that hike. But a lot of memories flooded back when I saw that there. I'm like, oh, I really, really would like that. So I go and I pick up the pack of cigarettes. And instead of putting them down, I pick up the pack of cigarettes and I open it up. And instead of closing it and putting it back down, I pick up the pack of cigarettes. I open it up. I take out a cigarette. And here's the weird part. I spend 5.5 minutes looking for a lighter. 5.5 minutes. And I'm like, oh, gosh, this is bad. But I smoke it and it's enjoyable. It's fine. I have a good time. I love cigarettes, as I've mentioned. But afterwards, I'm like, why did I do that? That was, in 5 years, the longest I had ever gone without smoking a cigarette, 2.5 months, and I just felt miserable, and I felt horrible, and it wasn't just mental, it was emotional, it was physical, my nose was running, I started coughing, and I just felt like a giant pile of poop. So I smoked it, and I guess I can't tell you the story of the last cigarette that I've ever smoked because I am not 100% confident in myself that that will be it, but I am 100% confident that it is no longer in my nature because I did not enjoy that cigarette. And you know what I did enjoy? I enjoyed going up Skyline Trail this morning and kind of being able to keep up with everybody even though I'm trying really hard at getting super fit. So thank you.
Thank you, Kat. That was awesome. And I have to say, wearing my hat where I deal with all the media on the peninsula and in Anchorage for the last 6 years through my job, I've seen different people with news come and go over the years. And I am super excited to be working with Kat. You've been reading her stories. She's so excited to tell good stories. And yesterday, she learned about this event a while ago, and she said she really wanted to come, and we were talking about the moth and storytelling, and I saw her yesterday where drones were flying around with a bunch of kids, and I said, you know, I said, we could use one or two more storytellers. I'll tell one. So she just decided and said yes yesterday that she would do this. So thank you, Kat. So it's my privilege to actually get to introduce Jenny to us right now, and Jenny has that voice, because we're hearing it now on the radio, that is so awesome, right? And I love that she can take translating words and writing and thoughtful stories and funny stories and soulful stories that she did in print for so long with Readout Reporter, and now in her current incarnation, as she says, so she's the general station manager at KDLL. And it's also really fun because at a borough assembly meeting, when I looked in the back corner one night, I saw Shaylin back at KDLL. So we've got some great things happening in our community with some stories and reporting and news. And so Jenny has a story, though, to tell us now about an adventure of nature and nurture, not sure. So Jenny.
Thank you, Peggy. So I wasn't in the middle of nowhere Canada because there is an awful lot of nowhere Canada. So I was more in the middle of not much Canada. I was about 3 weeks into a 4-month road trip down the Alcan, across the country, trying to hit as many national parks as I could. So I would hike during the day and then drive to my next trail and sleep in my car at the trailhead and get up and hike again the next morning. And it was September, and I was in the Rocky Mountains, kind of north of Jasper National Park, I think the Alberta side of that. And I got to that particular trailhead pretty late at night. It was about 11:30, so I park, and I figure, okay, I need to get straight into bed. But by this point in the trip, I had a pretty good routine down for all my little systems. I had built a little bunk in the back of the car, so bedtime meant take off my coat and make sure my car keys are safe in the pocket and put that back on the bunk, take my cell phone and my headlamp and stow those by my pillow in case I needed them in the middle of the night, and then I get out the driver's side door, and I open the back door, and I hit lock on the driver's side door, and I close that, and then I get in the back door and pull it closed behind me so I'm all nice and safe and secure for the night. Except that particular parking lot, I didn't realize it when I drove in, but was it kind of an incline? Not enough so it was really visible, but enough so that when I locked and closed the front door and went to pivot to get in the back door, I just barely managed to hip check the door, and with that and the incline was enough to swing it shut. And of course it was already locked. So now my coat and my keys and my cell phone and my headlamp are all snuggled, all nice and secure in my nice warm sleeping bag in my now locked car. That sleeping bag was so nice and warm, in fact, that even though it was September in the Rocky Mountains, I didn't have to wear a lot of layers to bed because it was so warm in there. And since I was ready for bed, that meant that I also had no pants. So what do you do in this situation? Of course, obviously, you break the window, right? So I find myself a good two-hander rock, and I line up on that window, and I whack it with everything it's worth. And that rock comes bouncing back at my face, because safety glass is no joke. They say shatter-resistant, and they mean it. I put 34 scratches in that window without so much as a hairline crack. At which point I realize, okay, I'm gonna need a plan B. So on my drive in, I had seen some houses, but they were a ways back and it is now pitch dark. So if I'm gonna walk myself to try and find help, I look up the other side of the road and way off in the distance, there's a light. So, okay, go towards the light, right? We've all heard this before. That seems like a plan. So I start walking. And eventually, I see that the road now goes through a fence, and I keep walking, and I get closer, and I see that this fence is topped with, yeah, that's razor wire. Keep walking, get close enough that I can start making out the signs, the majority of which are along the lines of stop, no entry, turn around, yes, we mean you. And there is one very large sign that designates the facility as a federal correctional institute. And I figure, well, I've made it this long in my life without going to prison. I guess that's gonna change. So I keep walking my half-naked self up into this prison past all kinds of signs in French and English saying no. And sure enough, up the road, there is a guard station, and I can see through the window that there is somebody manning the guard station, but I think the guard was probably more concerned with people breaking out of the prison than breaking into the prison, because he did not see me coming. So I get up there, and I knock on the glass to get his attention, and I scare the maple syrup out of this guy. He looks at me and goes, ah! And then he looks down at me and goes, ah! And all I could do at that point is go, hi. And you always hear that Canadians are the friendliest people on the planet, right? This gentleman was not happy that I was there. But he was friendly, I suppose, enough to let me use his phone. So I call the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, as one does in that situation. And luckily, the dispatcher was one of the friendliest people on the planet. Oh, dear. Oh, I'm so sorry. Let's see what we can do for you. So she looks up the phone numbers of three tow truck companies in the vicinity. Of course, this being middle of not much Canada. In the vicinity meant 50 to 100 miles. And it is now about 1 in the morning. So I dial the first number, and it rings. And it rings, and it rings, and it rings, and it rings, and rings, and rings, and rings, and rings. No answer. Okay, number two, fax machine. Okay, lucky number three. And it rings, 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 and it rings. And at that point, I'm trying to game out in my head, like, I don't know which is worse, having to stay in here with this guy, at least it's warm, or I really don't want to stay in here with this guy. Please answer the phone. Sure enough, eventually, a very sleepy man answers the phone, and he luckily was also one of the friendliest people on the planet, because he says, sure, I'll come let you into your car. So we work out where exactly I am. And I go running my pasty self back down the road to meet him, expecting at any moment that these gates are going to slam shut in front of me, but no, they do let me actually leave the prison. And I get to my car just about the time he is pulling up. Now, he gets out of the car, and if he notices that I am missing a significant portion of my wardrobe, he does not let on. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't ask anything. I don't notice him so much as even glance down. But he does proceed to start lecturing me about how dangerous it is for me to be out at night all alone, and you really should be more careful about this. And he's an older gentleman, so I figure I'm getting the fatherly lecture about, you know, stranger danger, and I'm going to get myself abducted or assaulted or something. And no, turns out he wasn't worried about other humans harassing me, as he starts to tell me, you know, it's really dangerous out here. You really got to be careful on account of the cougars. The what? Oh, yeah, this area, it's lousy with cougars. Again, what? Oh, yeah, those houses up the road, yeah, they lose pets all the time. They can't let their kids play outside at night. Just, you know, on account of the cougars, because they'll get ya. And at this point, I am not the friendliest person on the planet. Sir! I am tired, and I am cold, and I just broke into a prison. And I don't know if you noticed, but I have no pants. Let me into the car. Which he does, and I am reunited with my clothes. And I learned three valuable lessons that night. One, I do not like to be in nature au natural. So I have made it a point to always have clothing within my direct control. Two, prisons should only be visited by appointment. And three, even if things don't necessarily get worse, they can always get weird. Especially on account of the cougars.
So we've had eight awesome storytellers tonight. What do you think? Are you going to come back? Woo! That was fun. And we have a special treat tonight. Meezy, would you like to come up and give us a share of whatever's speaking to you to speak to us?
I pace too much to be set down, and I was not planning on speaking tonight, so I'm going to cheat, maybe. We'll see if I can remember this one. So this is called The Seventh Wave. Quote, folklore says the seventh wave is bigger than the previous six, and there's some statistical evidence to back this up. Breverton's Nautical Curiosities. It's a lumpy day on the flood, and the day brought all the troubles that come with 20-foot tides in Cook Inlet. If the force of the wind increases by the square of its speed, well then by my careful calculations, we are toast. We have two choices, to go or to stay. Maritime wisdom suggests keeping a thumb's width from danger as measured on a nautical chart. If only it were that easy. With no protected port, a sou'wester is a double-edged sword. It often brings bounty. It always brings hardship. It can blow the run inshore, but in order to reap the reward, we have to launch straight into the storm. No matter whose thumb is used for the measure, today we are well within a digit of danger. This season we are short-handed, but making the best of it. Stormy days we feel it most. With our pared-down crew, we decide to launch. John drops the skiff in the surf, but before he can park Alice in the trailer, we are blown off the pull-out line. I can't recall the last time we had a failure to launch. We try again. Trailer the skiff. Drop it in the surf. This time my cousin's crew helps us hold steady, waiting for the flat spot. I don't count to see if it comes after the seventh wave. Folklore can't help us now. We hop in the skiff and pull it into the froth. Waves break over the bow, soaking us before the outboard's even running, but we manage to get clear of the beach. Sou'westers always bring hardship. It's time to see if this one brings a bounty.
What a treat. So it is about 24 minutes until Odie's closes. We want to thank Odie's for hosting us again tonight. Thank you. And how awesome is it to have a place to gather and tell stories? Ben from the Clarion called me today. Did he grab you tonight and interview you yet? Oh, so the deadline still has a few more hours. You might get a call, Jenny. He already got Caitlin. But he was asking me a lot of actually really thoughtful questions. Like, well, what's different about writing a story, or like what I do where I'm helping share school stories, versus actually hearing somebody tell a story or telling a story? And I shared, you know, it takes a whole different kind of courage in a way to get up here. And he said, but you said you have a practice, which we're now starting to do. So this is a little plug for any of you in the room that might have a tickle inside of you that maybe you too would like to tell a 7-minute story. So on October 13th, which happens to also be a Friday, we have our next storytelling night with the theme of family, recipes for disaster. So if you think you might have a story that you'd like to tell, tap me or Jenny or Caitlin or message us on our Facebook page, True Tales Told Live. And along with that, I shared with Ben, I said, you know, we've done a couple times where we do a practice the night before, and not everybody can come, but some of us gather. So he asked me a good question, I thought. He said, well, if you're practicing, then isn't it kind of a performance more than it is, which I had just explained, when you have to share a 7-minute live story, you take off all your masks. I mean, it's kind of vulnerable to get up here and do this. And I said, well, actually, the practice is kind of like an editor, or when you used to tune into the radio and it'd be kind of staticky and you try to tune it in closer and get the sound crystal clear, where we have a group of us where everybody's sharing the story and we're listening to each other and we're saying, you know, I wanted to hear more about that part of it. Or if you're going to get it to 7 minutes, where are you going to lose those extra 2 minutes, which is some of the feedback I got. And actually, Jenny and I both did, right? But it's a really cool sense of us that are sharing the stories of listening to each other and offering really constructive, helpful insight. And then I shared with him, he said, well, what else makes it so interesting, or why do we even need storytelling when our world now is so connected in ways that it's never been connected for? Because I'd been saying, I just feel like the room, there's this connection that happens between us. And I think it's because we listen to each other. We're not problem solving. We're not debating. We're simply being present. So I want to say thank you on a Friday night for the fifth time for each of you for showing up tonight and being present and listening. And for those of you that shared stories and risked, thank you. For our musician, thank you. And for coming out and caring for one another, thank you. We need more of this. So I just am I told Ben, I said, it's one of my favorite things, actually. It just, I laugh and I cry and it's awesome. So on that note, that's what I have to say. Jenny.
I think you about covered it, Peggy. But if anyone has any inkling to do this, or if you know of someone that you think would be either already good at it or able to be tweaked into giving it a try, please let us know. It's a very friendly group. The rehearsals are really helpful. It's a fun experience. It is a little terrifying. Anytime one of these awful things are involved, it adds another level of discomfort, but it's always good to kind of force yourself to try new things and get over that those barriers to share with people. And that's how we get to know each other better, even though this evening is very one way. We hope that we will inspire some of you to come back our way and be up on the mic next time. So please let us know. Facebook, True Tales Told Live. We'll both be hanging out for a little bit. Caitlin is very accessible in the community. So any one of us, please let us know. We would love to answer questions and see some new faces the next time on October 13th. All right. Thank you all for coming.